Hi, everybody. Happy New Year. And a great way to kick off with Koshchurie. I'm sorry that Michael hasn't made it, but I believe he has a certain amount of Koshchurie at home to catch up on. And maybe we'll see him later. Are we ready to go?
Yes.
Yeah, ready to go.
Okay. You have got a wonderful array. I have a cup of pure tea, but nonetheless, can't have everything. So the Koshchurie family, if we go back a couple of generations, we have a chap called Léon Koch, and he had three children, at least three who matter in terms of inheritance. There's Georges Koch, who's father, late father of Jean-François, and then Jean-François's son, Raphael, now in charge. But there's also Georges Koch had an elder brother called Julien, whose son, Alain, had a business called Domaine Koch de Bourg, and then Koch Bizois, and now it's in his son Fabien's hands, Domaine Fabien Koch, who makes some pretty nice wines in Meursault, mostly at village level. And Léon Koch also had a daughter called Marthe, and Marthe had a daughter called Geneviève, and she married a guy called Guy Rouleau. And so she is, they are parents of Jean-Marc Rouleau. So in fact, Jean-Marc Rouleau is a great-grandson of Léon Koch, as indeed is Raphael Koch-Durie. So that's the usual intricate way of doing things in the everybody marries everybody else and brings their vineyards in. So Léon Koch didn't have that many vineyards, but his son George added quite considerably to the holdings. He took over in 1964, but he had problems with his back. And as early as 1973, Jean-François Koch, now Koch-Durie, because he married a lady called Odile Durie. So Jean-François Koch-Durie took over in 1973, and it's he who really built the incredible reputation of the domain. And when I first visited in 1981, the first two people I went to see were Domaine des Comtes Lafonts and Domaine Koch-Durie. And in those days, Koch-Durie was hardly known, just beginning to happen. And, you know, it was possible to go and taste there. And even he was available still for some markets. And it was only quite a bit later that prices started to go up and the whole thing really took off. And even then, for the longest time, Jean-François tried to keep his prices down from the domain. And it was only really the secondary market that started accelerating things. You know, be careful what you wish for, because now these things are a little bit out of control in Burgundy. So why did he get this incredible reputation? And it's not particularly because he's got the best placed vineyards. It's still true that the majority of the vineyards are at village level rather than amongst the crews. And then they're in good village vineyards. And it's only more recently that the Grand Cru Corson Charlemagne has arrived, and he doesn't have big holdings in the Premier Crus, except perhaps in Meursault-Perrier. So I suppose that is the grandest of them. So we'll go through a bit more detail, but the real quality, I think, comes about through his absolutely fanatical, meticulous approach to everything he does. Now, he's not organic in the vineyards. They're not biodynamic, neither of those things. They do what's called lutte raisonné, i.e. they try to minimize sprays and additions and so on. They weren't amongst the first to start plowing the vineyards, so they do that now. And they haven't moved into the sort of the cover crop theory of the some of the cutting edge people of today. But nonetheless, they'd always spend all their time. You could normally only get a tasting in the evenings because they would spend all their time out in the vines with real care and attention. And their vineyards always look spectacularly in good condition. So I think the vineyard work is really very important. And it's causing anxiety now for Raphael Koch, because it's a source of worry as to where global warming is taking the vines, and therefore ultimately the wines of Burgundy. Then you come to the cellar, and idiosyncratic things going on here in the cellar. Everything, of course, is handpicked, is barrel aged with quite a long aging. So it used to be 12 months in barrel. They would then be racked and then be returned to barrel for, depending on the duvet, between another 6 and 9 months. So that second winter in wood is important. They've always quite believed in lee stirring. It's the length of time in barrel plus the lee stirring, which has given the typical costery characteristics of those struck match gunflint aromas. Because this is one of several domains, it's not unique. We have this reductive style of winemaking. They also used to bottle by hand. And one factor that I skipped over a bit too quickly was when they come to press the grapes. For a long time, they maintained the old-style mechanical Vaslin press. After years of experimenting, renting a press and experimenting, they did buy a pneumatic press as well. So both. But if you use the old-style press, it actually, as I said, it's mechanical rather than pneumatic, and it tends to mash up the skins. And so you get something which is has more of the polyphenols from the skins involved. And that, again, can give you more of a reductive character in the wines, especially when they're young. Now, they continue with both. They haven't completely switched to the pneumatic side, but sometimes the pneumatic press is the more practical to use. So if from when there have been changes in recent times, maybe we'll come to that in discussing the wines. But what we've tried to do today is to find a sensible balance between the vintage of the different wines you've got and the vineyards. So in an ideal world, we'd go from youngest to oldest, but equally we would go from village level up to Grand Cru, up to Premier Cru and Grand Cru. But we've had to mix them in a little bit because we've got a couple of younger vintages. So I think you're going to be served the first flight. Is anything served yet? No?
Yep. Yes. Well,
so, good. So you've got four wines.
It's the 2008 Onseigneur,
yeah.
The 2018 Genevrier, and yeah. Then the 2011 and 2014 Meursault Village.
Okay. Right. So we begin with the Pulini Onseigneur. So that's, apart from the Corton Charmant, it's, I think, the only white wine they have outside Meursault itself. So it's a super vintage Onseigneur. It almost touches, it does touch, in fact, Batard-Maraîcher. It's at the southern end, the Chassagne-Maraîcher end of Puligny. These vines, I have read that they were purchased by the domain in 85 or 86, but the earliest vintage that I remember seeing is 95. And it's a strong player in the costume lineup, even though it's not not from Meursault. A vintage that was a late-ish harvest, not the best weather, but it was drier with a north wind in late September, which dried everything out and has made quite a concentrated of high acid wines. And alongside that, you've got a wine that's 10 years younger, which is Meursault Genevrier, which is the smallest of the Premier Cru holdings that the domain has. Old vines, though, planted in 1947. This is a vintage, in fact, where Raphael Koch started to use a little bit more new oak. Raphael, who took over from his father after 2010, though dad is still very much around, and I'm sure giving advice, possibly, I think probably no longer helping in the vineyards, but he certainly continued to work for a few years after his official retirement. So if you'd like to taste those first two and get some ideas on how they're doing. Yes, I mean, 10 years apart, and with the younger one being the Premier Cru, is going to make a slightly odd tasting partnership, if you like. I tasted the 2018 with Raphael Koch in spring 2020. And then I said it's fine, light lemon color, beautifully perfumed, little extra sweetness over and above the juniper, which I always often find juniper as a tasting component of Genevrier. Or perhaps it's more verbena, which can be characteristics of Genevrier. The 2018 is notably spicy, the purest white fruit and Great Lakes. 94 points for what that's worth. I haven't recently tasted the Pinot Noir Seigneur. So, someone want to be spokesman for that pair of wines? Tell me how they're showing. Who's going to volunteer?
Well, I think they're both showing well, but the Genevrière is really drinking beautifully, even though it's quite young. And it just seems to be sort of a step up. The Olsenier is also quite beautiful, but it doesn't have, to me, like the character, as much of the characteristic poche that you look for.
Yes, I wonder if the fact that it's Pudigny makes a difference. Also, of course, with 10 years extra age, then that initial aspect of the gunflint will reduce. What I found of 2008 originally was that they seemed to have a strong concentration of fruit up front. They had high acidity at the back, but they were a little bit, there's a little bit of a hole in the middle. Now, the question was, would the two halves rather fall apart, or would the whole wine knit together and cover up the hole in the middle? And on the whole, I'm happy to say I think that's what's happened. And in many cases, I think 2008 should be in a good place to drink now. And I wouldn't, in general, recommend keeping them for a great deal longer.
Your comment is for all 2008s or for?
Yes, no, that's a general comment about 2008 whites, rather than Koch specifically. And in 2018, again, a general comment, I think vintage has been slightly undervalued in white because it was a big crop and because it was a hot year. But those two things have slightly cancelled each other out. And I find the wines are putting on more character as time goes by. They're still only babies. They're not too high in alcohol. The reds can be, but the whites are not because of the size of the crop. And actually, I think this is a vintage that's going to show pretty well in the long term. So certainly 5 and maybe 10 years from now, I think they'll be really getting into their stride. That's my opinion, which is a slight outlier against the general received opinion, which is less favorable for 18 whites. Okay, so when I first met Genevrier all those years ago, I didn't think it had quite the same character and punch as the Perrier. In more recent years, I think it's rather caught up. So your next two wines are village wines, 14 and 11. Doesn't really matter which order you taste them. And what I'm expecting out of those two is 11 should be fully ready to drink. It was a decent white wine vintage without being spectacular. It seemed to have all the characteristics it should have without developing an immense personality. But now, 10 years on, it should be just about in its best place. And then 2014 is a vintage that we thought was very good when it came out. It's fresh. It's got good acidity, but it's not too aggressive. Excellent fruit. And ever since then, my opinion has only got higher on this vintage as the wines are taking a long, long time to come around. So I wouldn't be surprised if that wine isn't definitely too young. Anyway, if you'd like to taste those two, and then we'll come back to those. I've got a feeling somewhere I tasted that 2011 Masso not too long ago. Okay, so just a reminder, as I'm sure you're all aware, that something labeled Masso from Gosherie will not be the same wine in every market because they identify their various different plots separately. They've got Narvo, Viroy, Castet, Luché, Chaume, and you get either one or a blend of them depending on which importer you are. And it tends to be fairly consistent year in, year out, but it's not put on the label. The importer themselves may know. And you will sometimes see on Cellar Tracker that there is one of those vineyards specified as part of it, because presumably whoever owns that bottle received the information from there. But you won't see it on the label. Mm-hmm. I have found my tasting note on the one of regulars at your tastings who's not with you today brought a bunch of 2011s into Burgundy last summer, and one of the whites was the Meursault from Gostery. And my tasting note then, give it 5 stars and 93 points for the village wine. That this is recognizably Gostery from the telltale Gunflint reduction. It's really beautiful as such, and I took time to linger over it. Gorgeous fruit, some citrus, some apple, a well-managed mouthfeel with considerable weight. With oxygen, the fruit came further to the fore and the Gunflint retired. Superb length. Tasted in July of last year. 2014, I don't think I will have tasted any time recently.
Jasper, the 11's drinking. I thought your tasting note was very good on that. The 11 is drinking beautifully at the moment.
Good. I'm A, pleased it's drinking beautifully, B, happy that you're drinking it, and C, glad that I got my tasting note right.
Well, your tick there. The 14 is, I think, will be the better wine, but it's still quite closed, I think, for me. I think it's still lovely, but it's got so much underneath it that you're not picking up, because you can see it's still there, but it's quite rounded and quite closed for me.
Yes, that doesn't surprise me at all. I mean, typically, I'm finding 2014s to be like that, still very backward, and I'm not looking at any that I've got in my own cellar at all, let alone people of the quality I've got. One I would just make is that I'm getting a little bit of feedback. So anybody who wants to speak as part of our exchange, then please make sure you use the Bluetooth thing. But otherwise, if the Bluetooth, any other Bluetooth things can be kept not too close to people, maybe in the middle of the table, then we won't get the feedback of other chatter. This gets broadcast subsequently, and it is one of the issues occasionally people tell us is that they get a little bit too much of the feedback. Okay. So your next two wines or three wines would be what?
Yep. 2011 Meursault Genevrier.
Yeah.
2009 Chevalier. And then a blind wine.
A blind wine after that, which I suppose might be a little bit darker in color.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, look, I will leave you a moment then to digest those. So Genevrier, we have already sort of cross-referred it. We've had an earlier Genevrier and we've had a different 2011. So that will be really interesting to see how it shows with those two parameters already on board. And then I'll talk about Chevalier after that. Okay. So firstly, the Meursault Genevrier 2011. How is that playing out in comparison to the other 2011, or indeed the Genevrier 2018?
I hate to say it, like it's good, but I don't think it's that much of a level, like, you know, that many levels higher than like the large
zero level.
Okay,
I just don't feel that way.
Is that a general view?
I mean,
yes.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Well, it'll be interesting if you keep them in your glass and go back a little bit later on and taste the village and taste the Genevrier side and just see if the Genevrier has come up or whether that's sort of a done deal, that there's not that much of an uplift. Then we have 2009, a vintage I really like for white Burgundy, as long as you picked at the right time. And Gostery is not a late picker, so they would have picked at the right time. And it's Chevalier, which is a lovely vineyard on the hillside, where it's getting reasonably steep. It's sort of, you have this little line of vineyards, Tesson, then Rougeau, which is rarely seen. But Gostery makes the best example. And we're going to have one tonight. And then after that, Chevalier. It's a very free-draining soil, but I find the wines really stylish from Chevalier. alongside a vintage, which has got a lot of energy and should have a lot of depth of fruit. So how's the Chevalier 09 tasting?
Really, really good.
Yeah, well, so with that wine in particular, it's a vineyard I like, a vintage I love, and 12 years out or 13 years out for a good village wine, that you should be in absolutely perfect prime territory there. I don't know who amongst you whose cellar that came from, but save a bottle for my next visit. Okay, so this brings us to your mystery wine. I imagine Scott knows what it is. I know what it is. Michael's not there to tell you what it is. It is quite a lot older. So I hope it's held up. I can see that the color is noticeably deeper. One of the reasons it's being served now is I won't be staying with you all the way through all of your 15 wines. So it's come in now so that I could get your comments and make a steer. It's a vineyard which is no longer made, was never made very much. I don't know the origin of the vines, whether they're their own vines or whether they had a farming contract. I'm guessing they had a farming contract. But it's it hasn't seen around. The last vintage on Cellar Tracker is 1999, so you know you're older than that.
Is it kosh?
Yes, it is, yes.
Good question.
Because fruit is really oxidized.
It's very oxidized. Okay. Well, I mean, it could be fully oxidized, but look, this was a minor vintage, which had a lot of rot in it. It was one of the first years after I started buying professionally, and I bought very little whites in this vintage. It's 1981. And I think, given that it's a bit oxidized, there's no point in trying one year because that won't really show. So, shall I tell you what the vineyard is?
Yeah, sure.
It is Meursault Premier Cru Charme, which any amongst you have drunk the Charme from Côte d'Ivoire before?
No.
I can't remember drinking one.
Why did they stop producing? What happened to the vineyard? Why did they stop producing?
I don't know. So they can't have owned the vineyard, and I don't think they would have been buying in any grapes in those days. I think they probably had a sharecropping agreement with an owner at one point, and later on took it back for their own use. That is an assumption. I don't know that.
Better than
Okay, so maybe what I'll do now is just talk through the wines which are still to come in the order I think they're going to be served. And then if you've got any questions, ask me questions, and I will leave you to enjoy the rest of your dinner. So what we have still coming up are straight village wines from 05, 02, and 99. And alongside the straight 05, you have the Rougeau 05. This is a vineyard that should be really good, but because there's no really famous person producing it, apart from Côte d'Ivoire, this Potinet Ampo has it, and a couple of other people, but there's quite a big plot that's in anonymous hands, and it would be great if somebody smart got hold of that. 05 is a vintage I find quite similar to 09, that's well known for its reds, quite a sunny year, but they should be in pretty good nick. 02 I love, should be totally mature, and 99 Village Meursault is getting old now, it's 23 years old, but I expect it to still be around and in in good condition, but it will be a fully mature wine, I'm assuming. And then where do we go after that? We then go back into the 90s, starting with the Village 99, and we have the two other Premier Crus in white, because of course Costery makes some lovely reds, including a Volnay Premier Cru. You've got the Caire in 96, which will be fascinating because that's an awkward vintage, a northeast wind, very sunny. So the sugar levels got there, but the acidity, it was very cold as well. So the acidity never really went down. And as a result, sometimes the wines are seem a little bit out of balance. It was a great candidate for the horrible premature oxidation as well. But fortunately, most of the wines, all the wines in my cellar at any rate, that were oxidized at one point, seem to have come back to life, which is a great relief. I'm hoping that that will show well. Caire is an extension. It's a little figure added on to the end of Volnay Caire, which, of course, is a red wine vineyard. And if you force me to choose, I would say that the Meursault Caire probably should be red grapes rather than white. After that, you have two vineyards of Perrier. Now, the domain has got much more Perrier than it used to have. And it's in two parts, Eau Perrier, where the holding is between Domaine Lafont and Davio Perrin, and Perrier, the upper part, which is between Michel Dutreau and Bouchard. But I think back in the 90s, they only had one of those slices. I think it was probably the Perrier Dessus that they had rather than Eau Perrier. 97 was a year that doesn't really have a reputation in any direction. Nobody talks about it much. It was a sunny year where the wines were good, but they lacked the cachet of a really great year. And then 93, which was a year that we all thought was a good red wine vintage. We never talked about the whites. And as older, it was the only year in which Jean-François Costery decided to join in our 10-year-on tastings. And he wine insisted it be decanted beforehand, and it was a star. But nowadays, we are really, really liking 1993 as a white Burgundy vintage. So I'm hoping that that will show well for you when you get there. And the last wine is going to be the legendary Courson Charmine 1999, which I have drunk with you in Hong Kong over a fabulous sushi meal at somebody in Wan Chai. I think it was, which I hope that some of you will have been there and will remember that. But it was completely spectacular. Just looking to see if I can bring up a tasting note. So alongside the 2002, the 99 offered significantly more depth of flavour, but noticeably less precision at that point. Full-on green and gold colour, but still with a pleasing brilliance. Mature and accessible nose, generously fruited, outstanding depth. In comparison with the 02, I thought it was perhaps a fraction vulgar. Perhaps that's harsh, as this is clearly a great wine and needs most of the company on the night. But I gave it 98 points, and I think I would have given the 02, see if I can find my notes on that, just a fraction more. But so you've got mature wine still to come, and I shall expect a report later on. But I'm hoping that they should all be in good nick. 99 points to the 02. So that we pretty much have all the vineyards, the main vineyards in white that Costery makes. Obviously, tonight you're not having any of the reds, which is the Volnay Premier Cru I mentioned. There's a very nice Village Auxerre d'Urres. There used to be a Pommard, but he got rid of that vineyard quite a while ago. And there is, I think there's a Bourgogne Rouge and a Montelie as well. And they're really nice, but unfortunately, the effect of Costery secondary market pricing on the whites started to take effect in the reds as well, which is not good news for anybody, because they were lovely wines at the right price, but you can't take them too far. Is there anything out of the tastings so far that you'd like to come back to me on any questions you'd like to ask, Lance.
I just put two questions. Like one, it's it's supposed to be the theme of the tasting. It's like we haven't touched on the difference between like the style between the father and the son. So
a lot okay, of, well, like, we haven't got enough wines from the son. I suppose the 2018, 2014, and probably 2011. I don't think there was initially. I think there was no change. There has been something out there in the marketplace of people saying, oh, well, the wines are not so good anymore. This can come in part from when you have a total superstar like Jean-Francois Coche, that maybe people are almost looking for it to be less good when it's not him making the wine. In part, Raphael has made some changes, but he took a little bit longer, so the 11s and the 14s wouldn't be in the frame. In the Côte de Beaune, 12, 13, and 14 were all very small crops. So he took the decision in 2015 to buy in a few grapes, but also in Mersey. And people thought, oh, well, that's going to change everything if they're not growing the grapes themselves. And then in 2016, as a result of the hideous frost damage in 2016, he went so far as to buy a lot of grapes from down in the Mâconnais. So his Bourgogne Blanc of that year only, is made with Mâcon grapes more than it is with grapes from around Mersey. Since then, he continues to buy some grapes for the Bourgogne Blanc and a little bit for Mersey, but they're really just from vineyards which are located close to where their house is at the southern end of, down by the main road in Mersey. So that could change things. The introduction of the pneumatic press could make the wines a little bit less sort of tightly wound and have a little bit less of the gunflint struck match aromas. And one other small change is that they no longer bottle everything from the barrel, so barrel by barrel. Now they have a bottling line, and the bigger cuvées, they will use the bottling line, and the small cuvées, they will still do it by hand. So there are changes. I think fundamentally the wines are recognizably the same. I think perhaps a bit less extreme in the reductive match character. And maybe the 2016s will be a little bit atypical. But in general, I don't think there is a really significant change. Okay.
There's a lot of people really like the reductive character, and they're complaining about like where it's like the gunflint and the matchsticks and all the stuff. So that's why like people are saying that, oh, good, yeah, since like Raphael took the baton in 2013,
people are saying that, 2011.
So it's not that great after all, especially 13 is a weaker vintage, like for them, right?
Yeah, I think 13 is a tricky vintage, and it's my least favorite white wine vintages. And it's a softer character anyway. So it may be, I haven't tasted his 13s. I'm not familiar with them. It may be that they're a little bit down. And it was around that period, 13 through 16, that you heard more of the sort of Coche isn't what it used to be discussion. And it is true that the reductive character has been dialed down, as it has also with Pierre-Yves Collin Moret. And probably also with Jean-Marc Rouleau as well. They all decided that they didn't want it to become a caricature of what the wine is about. So yes, in your blind tastings, Custery becomes that little bit harder to pick, maybe.
I see. And another question is like, so now the Meursault like got a bit of like the other like new additions. What would you think that is the best, the best secondary market price? Like we're talking about secondary markets, not allocation. It's like what's the sweet point for Côte d'Or? Like, do you think it's like still the Meursault or the Rouge or the Rouget or like some other cuvée?
Okay. Part of the answer to that is that I don't follow the secondary market pricing. I find it's and anything you guys can do to calm it down without losing your options of getting hold of wines, that would be great. I don't know, what's the premium between a single vineyard like a Rougeau over the regular Mersey.
Maybe
30%,
yeah. Maybe 30%, something like that.
2x. I think, if it's 30%, then you go with Rougeau. If it's 2x, you probably wouldn't. So that's quite a wide range you've given me to play with. I'm convinced that until you get up to Perrier, that you necessarily get a sufficient additional uplift for Caire and Genevrier, make it necessary to hunt after those. If you've got the Meursault or Meursault plus Lierdi or Puligny-en-Seigneur, then I think you're already in a really good place. Court of Charlemagne, I have to come and see you guys to drink that anyway. So, but happily, it has happened from time to time. There is a question that you ask every time you have a grower with me is, if you could have another vineyard, what would it be? So if we play with that for Costuri, I am going to suggest that I think it would be wonderful if he's going to stay in Meursault, then you've got various of the Premier Crus, or if we were to give him one more of the village vineyards, then I'd love to have enough Narvo to make a cuvée of Narvo. He's got a little bit anyway that gets blended in, but if he had a Narvo for a cuvée on its own, I'd quite like to see what he would do with a Premier Cru Punini Moriche. Maybe the one that's next door to Perrier, the Champ Canet, could be fun. Or his style of wine, I think if you were to give him a Grand Cru, another Grand Cru, would be most suited to Chevalier Moriche rather than Bâtard. Anyway, he's not here to answer himself. Next time I see him, I will ask that question.
Hey, Jasper, what do you think of the 2021 vintage in whites?
In general, I think it is... I'm seeing the merchants are getting hugely enthusiastic about 2021 in both colors. I would be a lot more moderate in my press for them. I think the reds in the Côte de Beaune are difficult. The reds in the Côte de Nuit are quite good, and I'm just writing them up at the moment. That will come out at the weekend. But the whites is such a small quantity. Some of the pricing is crazy. I hear that Antoine Jobard has doubled the price of his Meursault Genevrier. That's now £100 a bottle, sort of direct from the agent. And there's no justification for prices to go up with the quality of the 21 whites. But they are good. For the most part, they're good. The acidity can be a little bit too trenchant. You had to make the right picking decisions because you did get a bit of rot later on. But the smart people who you could trust to make the right decisions have made good wines. I haven't tasted Costuri 21, though. Not yet.
So is it a year where, like, the whites are better than the reds, or are they on par?
In the Côte de Beaune, it's clearly whites. And I started out thinking the whites are better than the reds. But actually, there are some reds in the Côte de Nuit which might be a good place to be for the vintage. The whites are less good than 2017, 14 for sure. They're a different style to 19 or 18. If I went back a bit in whites, maybe 2012 would come into the picture a little bit. So they're good wines, but they're not going to be especially long-lived. And they're not wines that you absolutely need to have in your cellar. But if you can get from a decent producer at a correct price, then it's worth doing.
Thank you.
Okay.
Question, like, yeah, for your own taste, like, how long would you like to keep the Costuri wines, like, let's say Meursault or the Rouge, before you open it for yourself?
Right. Well, first of all, I do have them in my cellar. So I have a couple of odd bottles which have turned up in one place or another. I will just, not sure if I still got a couple left. I will just verify that even as we talk. But I think, for example, 2009, you had the Chevalier, 2011, you had the Strait, and they're in near perfect places, I suspect. So they would definitely be in a perfect 12 years sort of window. That's what I would have said anyway. And now I'm just going to try and see if I can find what I may have. Because I had the opportunity to buy Costrui wines professionally back in 1981, and I didn't choose. I have one bottle of 1999 Mercer, which I don't seem to have got around to drinking yet, and I have one bottle of 2008 Mercer. So maybe next time I need something, missed out this Christmas and New Year, maybe that 1999 Mercer would be a good thing to do. Okay.
Jasper, yeah. Sorry, it's that Paul here. Just a very quick question. I'm just curious of your comments in relation to 2008. Because I've got a few 2008s and I was keeping them, but you seem to suggest that irrespective of the producer and well, it's Grand Cru Premier, you would be drinking them right now. Is that? Can you just explain a bit?
If you've got, on the whole, yes. It was a period before people had gone to using Diam. I don't know exactly which wines you've got. If you and if you've got several bottles, then obviously you can start drinking them now, and then you can change your mind if it's one that's proving in the glass. But typically, I would be looking to drink them or start drinking them at any rate.
Yeah. Okay.
Are you more at the village level or Premier Cru or Grand Cru?
A mixture of all three.
Yeah. I mean, I don't remember tasting the last couple of years an 08 where I felt you definitely need to keep it because otherwise you're not getting value from it. That would be my view in general. Have you had one recently, Satpal, that you felt?
No.
Ready?
Only occurred to see your Pat next to me, and that was a couple of years ago. But okay. I haven't dropped 008 recently.
Right. I'm just having a quick look at my 2008 10-year-old tasting and just to see if I don't think I've done. No, I didn't do enough of an introduction to that. I haven't got anything else really to and that was 4 years ago anyway when we tasted them, so I haven't got any updated information, but I would certainly start looking at them.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you all for starting the year in fine style with some Costrui wines. Incidentally, I would just mention that I have been saying Kosh throughout, and my American friends always tend to say Kosh. But here it would be pronounced in Burgundy, it's pronounced with a shorter O as Kosh rather than Kosh. Continue to enjoy. You've got your second flight of seven. You've got food to eat. I've finished my cup of tea. And I will see you. I'm not sure when our next online Zoom will be. As you know, I am hoping to come to Hong Kong in April. And we'll see you all there.
Yeah. See you in April. Thank you.
Bye, guys. Bye, guys. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Bye-bye.
Just one thing is, like, we beat you for the aging part. Like, we are still on, like, 2004 for the Christian Merceau and the Huje, and, like, you're now on 2008. Like, it's finally we beat you for the aging part.
Okay, good. Good. Well done. Good to see you guys. Bye.